That's like a Jadakiss laugh. Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a new podcast from the bitterly young, delectably hip, and fragrantly lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. Oh, I gotta introduce everyone. Sorry, I got so excited.
But that was perfect.
Thank you. So I'm Olga Segura, here with Zach Davis.
Hello, everyone.
So that intro sounded a little different because Ashley's actually in Rome right now.
I know. Did you hear that?
Did I hear what?
That was the sound of everyone who is a fan of Ashley just tuning out of the podcast. But if Ashley is in fact the only reason that you listen to this show, stay tuned because she will show up later in the podcast because we recorded the interview section of this a couple weeks ago when Ashley was here.
We got a lot going on this week. We're moving from our current office to our next permanent, and this will be the last time. We've moved twice this year, but this will be the last time. So we're moving Friday.
And, you know, I hear we have a pretty cool studio in the new place, which is very exciting.
It is very exciting.
If you've been listening for a while and you've enjoyed the sounds of sirens in the background or construction work, I think those are going to be things of the past, theoretically.
Yeah.
So exciting.
Yeah. So what's on tap, Zach?
So since we're moving, we decided to clean out the fridge, right? Because no sense buying anything new if it's all just going to... So we've got some beers from a couple weeks ago. We've got the Sierra Nevada Oktoberfest, which still relevant, still October. So cheers to that.
Cheers.
Yeah. Did we have more or were there only two?
It's just two. Like we are literally clearing out all what
right,
we
so
have left.
I will nurse this one I've got until the bitter end.
And who are we talking to this week?
So this week we are talking with Sister Simone Campbell, celebrity nun, and also the leader of Nuns on the Bus and the executive director of Network. It's a lobby for Catholic social justice. And after that, we will be bringing you our Consolations and Desolations, the part of the show where we talk about where we did or did not find God this week.
But first, it's time for Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news so you guys don't have to. What's first, Zach?
Well, it's Halloween this week, and Halloween costumes is a time where we all talk about what's appropriate to wear and what's not.
Right.
So, and I was in one of those Halloween pop-up stores that opens, and I noticed that there was a little section of the store where, like, there are some Catholic costumes where you could dress up as either the Pope or a priest or a sexy nun costume.
Right.
Which some sisters are finding pretty problematic.
Right. So there's this one sister who claims that when she sees women dress, or just people in general on Halloween dressed as sexy nuns, it's actually kind of insulting. She says, you know, my religious life is something I take very, very seriously. And the same way you wouldn't wear other problematic costumes, you shouldn't wear religious costumes. And, you know, she goes as far as making a comparison to people who wear blackface or stereotypical costumes of other races.
Is it the same as maybe someone going in blackface or wearing a sombrero and a fake mustache?
It's definitely not. I think that when you see people in blackface, it's problematic because you literally have people appropriating like the race and identity of another human being, you know, and it's usually someone doing it for a race that's been marginalized.
Part of it is you can choose to be a nun, right? That's a choice that everyone makes. You don't choose to be black or Mexican or, and so I think that's an essential difference. That said, whether you're thinking about being a sexy nun or an unsexy nun, just know that maybe the real nuns of the world may not look too kindly upon that. What's our next story, Olga?
Zach, do you think you're a good person?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't know. Do you think you're a good person?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. The reason we're asking this is because a recent report just came out from the Pew Research Center, which claims that 56% of Americans think that in order to be a good person, you don't have to believe in God. And 49% of U.S. Catholics agree with this. I found this really interesting because for me, someone who's raised Catholic, who went to Catholic schools, I can't separate my sense of what it means to be good and what it means to be bad from my faith. But of course, I would not hold it. I don't think you have to believe in God to be a good person. But it's so fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't love this dichotomy. I don't know. When I was in college, when people would find out that I studied both philosophy and theology, or even before that, whenever I was just sort of like vaguely religious and high school, people would always ask me, you know, well, do you think you have to believe in God to be a good person? And really, they're not actually looking for my opinion. They just want me to say, no, you don't have to, so you're good.
Right.
You know, what I'm actually, I don't think it's helpful, one, because I think what's a more interesting question is, what does it mean to be a good person? Right? I actually don't think we can agree on that in general. Or what does it mean to believe in God? Is that like a, is that a state of being that's constant? Or do you fade in and out of that? Is there doubt? How does your faith or doubt in God influence your morality? I don't know, but you can't really get into that if you're a random pollster calling random phone numbers, I guess.
Right, right.
Though some people think they're so good that they're the only Catholics in the world, even though they've been excommunicated.
Right, right. So Dan Brown is actually out with a new book called Origins, which the focus of the book is really, really interesting. And Zach, I know you fell down a slight rabbit hole on this one, so I'll let you explain what the focus of this book is.
Yes. So Dan Brown is out with the new book, as you said. This is the author of The Da Vinci Code, his all these other thrillers that he writes. And he's somewhat famous in Catholic circles for always getting Catholicism
really wrong. Yeah.
Right. But he has this new group of people in the new book called the Palmarian Catholic Church. And fun fact, they actually exist. And so he writes about this creepy sect that exists in Spain where they have their own cathedral and their own members.
And they even have their own pope, correct?
Yes. They think that they've had about five popes. They left the official Catholic Church. They thought that Paul VI was the last real pope, and so they've declared him a martyr. Unclear why they think he's a martyr, if he just died from natural causes. I don't know. Maybe they think he was murdered. Anyway, there's this caused me to fall down a deep, deep Wikipedia rabbit hole. They've got hovering around 1,000 numbers, but there's some question that they're going to die out probably pretty soon because no one's converting to this. Unsurprisingly.
Right, right.
And it looks a little Catholic, right? But it's going to look much more like a pre-Vatican II church. And so some things are going to look the same, but they've got some different beliefs that I think are interesting. And basically, they think they excommunicated John Paul II, which was...
That's interesting that you excommunicate an actual Catholic pope.
Right. Well, it's sort of like, oh, well, you excommunicated me. Well, no, I excommunicate you, which...
And they also, I think, the Eucharist, they believe that the Virgin Mary is the real presence in the Eucharist.
As well as Christ. But yes, that is another funny belief they have. But there are a lot of, there were actually a lot of schismatic groups in the 20th century in the fallout of Vatican II that all had a sort of have these like small memberships. There are some that have larger memberships, but this is one of the fringe ones that, you know, has about 1,000 people and will probably die out soon.
Okay. Well, I guess Dan Brown is going to help them get more members in with this new book.
Maybe. I don't know. Dan Brown sends a lot of people on his main characters on, you know, detective hunts, and he sent me on a Wikipedia one. All right. What's next, Olga?
Have you seen the latest Bill O'Reilly news? He's just so awful.
Yeah. So Bill O'Reilly, who is a Catholic, recently said on his web series, No Spin News, that he was mad at God over the allegations that he has sexually harassed and assaulted some of his former coworkers. This comes after the New York Times released its latest report that he reached a $32 million settlement with one of his former colleagues. And this is sort of part of a pattern for him. No word from how God has responded to.
Right, right. Yeah, this is so frustrating because he is completely trying to make himself the victim in this situation and not all of the victims who have come forward with these allegations. And this is coming in light of other news that we've been seeing coming out of Hollywood with Harvey Weinstein, James Toback, and Terry Richardson, you know, other men who a lot of women are coming forward with these same kind of allegations.
And what's been interesting is like a lot of these things, when they happen, seem very distant because they're celebrities and they're higher up people. But the sort of social media campaign that's resulted from it has really brought a lot of this close to home for people, right?
Yeah. So I think it was Alyssa Milano who was on Charmed. Shout out to Charmed, who started this Me Too campaign and just was asking women, to, if they had been victims of sexual harassment, sexual assault, to come forward and share your story, whether it was actually detailing it or just tweeting out "Me Too." And it's been really great to see this. People have come forward, and it's been this really big moment of solidarity. But what is kind of frustrating is that survivors, these women have been coming forward for years. Like in the case of Terry Richardson, their women had been accusing him of sexual harassment like 6 years ago, and nobody was listening to them. You know, survivors have been telling their stories, you know, and I think we need to shift the narrative a little bit and not just focus on like, hey, women should come forward, women should do this, and we should start talking about what can men do in these situations, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. What was it you said? We were talking about this earlier, that every woman knows someone, but...
Yeah, it's fascinating. Every woman knows someone who, every woman most likely has been sexually harassed at some point in her life. And every woman knows someone who has been sexually harassed or sexually assaulted. But if you were to flip the question and ask men, do you know anyone who has sexually harassed or sexually assaulted someone? Most men would say no.
Right. And it sort of raises the question, you know, where, who's doing all the harassment, right?
Right, right.
This is like, I don't know, it's... I felt overwhelmed like reading all of these stories to the point where like it's easy to feel helpless, but like the starting point for me was, okay, I need to reassess my own place in this culture, like how have I aided and abetted this to exist, how do I respond to it. I don't think men have learned how to either support or respond in ways that are healthy. That's been challenging for me, which we actually had an article.
Yeah, we had Ken Homan, who is a contributor at the Jesuit Post, wrote a piece titled "I'm a Jesuit, How Should I Respond to Toxic Masculinity and Me Too?" And it was really powerful because he acknowledges a lot of what you just said, Zach. Like, how do I deal as a man? How do I deal with these issues? You know, and I think what's important is the first step is you have to acknowledge your privilege as a man, and you have to acknowledge that, yes, even if you don't want to admit it, you have been complicit. If you have been around a guy who has said something like, you know, she shouldn't have dressed that way, you know, then you should call out your friends. And I think the first step is to be like, okay, what have I done? As a man, I don't understand this, but what can I do?
And what's maybe that's not super clear right now, but the thing that he brings up is he says that I would love to apologize and go back to comfortably occupying my male dominated spaces. I'd love to tweet some catchy statements and feel better about myself, but hashtag me too is forcing me to sit, to stay, and to pray. It's forcing me to listen, to accompany, and examine my history and my heart. And so this is like a real, not that there haven't been chances in the past, but we look at the moment that's in front of us right now. And it's one to do those things that he's talking about and really look at how we fit into this.
And I've had this conversation with a lot of my male friends lately, to not give into that instinct that I think a lot of men have to say, well, not all men, I haven't done that. And it's like, no, I'm not saying that you are a rapist or these awful things, but it is okay for you to be like, how have I engaged in this culture and what can I do and how can I listen to the people who are telling me to be better, you know?
Always look at where your first instinct is, I think. If it's one of defense, not healthy. If it's to escalate immediately to anger, then not healthy. And so the real challenge then for us is to listen and reflect and discern and also be contemplatives in action, right? That's sort of the Jesuit motive, is to think about these things but also act on them.
Today, we're excited to welcome the Executive Director of Network and Leader of Nuns on the Bus, Sister Simone Campbell. Welcome to Jesuitical, Sister.
Ah, great to be with you.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you. So our first question, what is Nuns on the Bus?
That's everybody's question. It's a good place to start. Nuns on the Bus is a project of our organization Network, and it started in 2012 when we went on the road to push back against the federal budget that then Congressman Paul Ryan had proposed. And he said that his Catholic faith inspired this budget. And we said that was wrong. This was not, it was a budget that would decimate the low-income communities of our nation and would hurt especially the working poor families. And so we went on the road to advocate against it. after that, we were only on the road 2 weeks, but it sort of got into people's imaginations. So we've done each year after that, except for this year, we've done a bus trip on a variety of things, on immigration reform, on trying to bridge the divides in politics.
You didn't have one this year?
No, we didn't have one this year. No. We had to stay in Washington, D.C. We really need help mending the gaps in politics. Yeah. So we stayed here because so many bad things are happening in Congress that we couldn't afford to be out of D.C.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of urgent times.
I didn't realize that Paul Ryan was part of the origin story of Nuns on the Bus. So I assume you've met him. And
yes,
you obviously disagree with his policies. But do you think he's motivated by his Catholic faith or something else?
Well, I mean, it's a little hard to look into his heart. He says he is. My only trouble with it is that he's misinformed about his Catholic faith. And the hard part's been is that I've taken him various things that Pope Francis has written, and like the Laudato Si, the encyclical on environment and poverty. I took Joy of the Gospel. I've read it. It's like, well, if you read it, you didn't take it in. So anyway,
yeah,
it's a little frustrating.
So the bus part is very noticeable when you guys are driving around the country. But what about the nun part? Why did you become a nun? And what do you think that brings to your work?
Oh, well, I became a nun way before I ever thought of a bus. But let's see. For me, I was always, as a young person, as a teenager, young adult, I was always about civil rights, and I'm getting old, so I can say when I was a kid, Dr. King's sermons, that got broadcast on television were really powerful. I saw the kids on TV in Birmingham standing up for integration of the schools. And so as a young person, I thought, well, if they could stand up, here I am in Southern California. I'm not in the South, but I can stand up too. Mm-hmm. And so my community, I'm a sister of social service, and so my religious community was founded in Budapest, Hungary in 1923, and then in Los Angeles in 1926. But in Budapest, our foundress was the first woman in the Hungarian parliament. So we've always known that there is an intersection of charity and justice.
That's pretty cool. I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the foundress's name?
She is Margaret Schlachta. She said that there were these four levels that Sisters of Social Service were supposed to work at. And the bottom level is direct service. The second level is group work, like in a settlement house, that kind of thing. The third level is movement work, things like Move On or the anti-nuclear movement or those kinds of things. And then, of course, because she was in the legislature, probably she thought legislation was the top, the pinnacle. But what she said was that legislation wouldn't be any good unless it's connected to the other three. And direct service would be less effective unless it was connected all the way through up to legislation. And for me, that has always been a big motivating thing, to know that we all hold a piece of the process of governance.
What would you say to, a young woman today who looks at what you're doing? You're a trained lawyer, right?
In addition
to being a lobbyist and a sister. And, someone might look at that and be like, okay, like I can be a lobbyist and a lawyer and a civil rights fighter without becoming a nun. Like, what would your case to them be?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you can. Go, do it.
What's distinctive about religious life when it seems so integrated with, just regular political life?
What I know is faith matters for nourishing our roots, keeping us from being hateful. I mean, in politics right now, people thrive on being hateful and sharing hate speech. And so for me, faith keeps me anchored in that. Can I give you one example?
We would love that.
Today, we work together in the interfaith community here in D.C., and at noon today, I was asked to lead a quarterly contemplative prayer time. And so I did this contemplative prayer time and asked everybody who came, a small group, but everybody who came is, come with a question that you're pondering, and then hold it in prayer. And so I took my question, but what happened to my question during the quiet 15 minutes of just quiet contemplative prayer was my question changed from how do we deal with healthcare and this administration to who will weep if we don't? And I realized the need for really for public weeping in order to provide any healing. And so for me, the intersection of my religious life and this work is that you get deeper insights, you get bolder ideas, and it's about the spirit breathing over the waters of chaos and making something out of it. I think that holding the spiritual practices at the heart of who we are is an intense way of living, and fidelity in community keeps
us... Do you live in community? I've always wondered that.
I don't currently live with other sisters, but I'll tell you one of the great gifts of the internet is that we can have as many fights on the internet as we do when you live in person almost.
Can you get the same nourishment that you do in person?
Well, no, but here's the thing. The struggles are nourishing because you keep engaged in... trying to find the faithful way forward together, to articulate it, to understand it. And that keeps me nourished, going, faithful. And I will say that prayer as a priority in religious life is something that my married colleagues have a harder time with, or my colleagues who have another life form find it surprising, and many people have said they're kind of jealous because my life is anything but a quiet life, and it's all about service and engagement. I don't know. And then my law partners, when I practiced law for 18 years, my law partners said that there was a qualitative difference with how I interacted with clients, and I didn't see it, but they saw it.
So, Sister Simone, you were at the Vatican for International Women's Day, and recently we spoke to the host of the Catholic Feminist podcast, Claire Swinarski, and one of the questions that we were discussing was, what does it mean to be a Catholic feminist? So would you describe yourself as one, and if so, where do you focus your attention as a Catholic feminist?
Oh, absolutely. I am Catholic and I'm a feminist, so I think that makes me a Catholic feminist.
The logic would follow.
Yeah, it was my legal training that helped me see that one. But I am deeply pained by the lack of women's leadership in the church. And so one of the reasons that I work in federal politics and not in church settings is because I just don't have patience for the church fight. So I think I'm less... I'm less engaged on the issues within the Catholic Church. I admire people who are able to do it, like Chris Shank, who started Future Church, is a friend of mine, and I admire Future Church greatly. And
what do they do?
They're working at promoting women's leadership at all levels, and rather than doing the Women's Ordination Conference, who I also admire, they're working on women in the diaconate because there's clear biblical references to that. I admire that work greatly, but it's not mine. I'm not patient enough for it. I'm just, of course, people laugh at me because I say I work in federal policy and stuff.
I was going to say, just so I understand you, you find church political fights too much, but
Congress is okay.
Congress is more hurly burly, and I can be, I can. And the truth of it is, I hate power imbalance. Mm-hmm. And so within the church fights, there are too many power imbalances, and I'm not good at those fights. Then I have a tendency to...
So do you think being a nun gives you an advantage or some sort of leverage in your interactions with high-profile political figures that you don't have in the church?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I know that. I know the fact that I'm a sister matters to Catholic members of Congress. I mean, it matters to Speaker Ryan. It matters to Leader Pelosi in a very different way. It's supportive to her. It's annoying to him.
Is it Catholic guilt? Is that what you're pointing to?
Yeah, it is Catholic guilt. But I think that there's a way, even with non-Catholics, that there's a kind of a moral authority, mm-hmm. an expectation of clarity that goes with the role, which is both gift and curse, because it then means that we have to be sure that we do stay true and not betray that trust.
Yeah. That's never happened before, so yeah, fine.
Right. But I think that's the expectation. That's the expectation I have, is that I won't betray that trust. And I get trusted with the stories of so many people because of it, that they become like this sacred community I carry around inside of me of stories people have told me. Jim Martin, Father Jim Martin said to me a while ago, he was interviewing me about something, and of course I'll tell all these stories. And he said, well, you know, that's what Jesus did. And I was like, really? Oh, I never thought of that. That's kind of cool.
So, Sister Simone, what issue are you most concerned about right now?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, can I have two? I have two.
Of course.
Well, actually, three. There's three.
Give a sister an issue. The three issues
that I am totally frantic about are healthcare that we've been working on, mm-hmm. preserving healthcare for vulnerable people. The second is tax policy. That's probably the policy where listeners will think, oh my gosh, isn't that boring? No, it's the most important policy for our income and wealth disparity in our nation. And what people are trying to do to give the top 1% this huge tax cut that was going to create a huge deficit. And then they're going to be surprised and say, oh, well, we have to cut all the social service programs because we don't have any money now. So that one just has me totally nuts. And
number three.
The other issue is immigration, that we willfully refuse as a nation to fix a system that was designed in 1960. Yeah. And if you had, anything designed in 1960, you'd think maybe we need to modernize it. But because of exploitation and the political game of blaming others, Congress is willfully refusing to fix it. Yeah. And that is, it's not Christian. Yeah.
When you put it that way, I understand why you don't have time for a road trip this year.
Yeah, right, right.
So, sister, it's a very overwhelming current political landscape. So how do we discern during these times? Like, how do we select which issue to focus on when everything feels so overwhelming in politics right now?
Well, right. Here's the challenge. That's where, for me, meditation becomes really important, and you listen to where you're called, because we can't do everything. And mm-hmm. as long as everybody's doing their part, then the whole community can respond to these times. But everybody has to do something. Hmm. So that's what I advocate. Everybody do something. And as long as we all do it, it'll get done.
Those are wise words. Sister, this has been great. We have one final question that we ask all of our guests. And that is, if you could canonize someone, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional.
Catholic or not.
Catholic or not. Who would it be and why? Give us the elevator pitch.
Oh, canonize. You know who I think I will pick? Is somebody you won't know, but Margaret Kistler. Margaret Kistler should be canonized because she was a shop steward in Cincinnati. She lost her job in 2009. When she lost her job, she lost her health care and ended up getting colon cancer and dying because of it. But in her illness, she still fought for the Affordable Care Act to be fully implemented. She engaged in trying to make sure that the folks from her business that she'd gotten laid off from were okay. When she was suffering, she kept an eye on others. And what's a better definition of a saint than that?
Saint Margaret.
Saint Margaret Kistler. Yep.
Pray for us.
Amen.
Sister, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really great.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah,
thank you.
Keep up the good fight.
Yeah. Come join us in D.C. It'll be fun. Or call your member of Congress and your senators, just where you are.
Just random question. Why is calling the only thing that works, supposedly?
It's the best thing that works because it's actually a human being talking to human being. And up on Capitol Hill, they have the feeling that emails are no longer really about grassroots. They call it AstroTurf, fake grassroots. So, but they don't have robocalls yet to Congress, so we know those are real.
Okay. Thank you. All right, well, have a great Alrighty. Rest of your day.
Thank you. Take care, y'all.
Thank
right, you.
You
too. Bye. And now it's time for some listener feedback.
So you may have seen on Twitter that we're interviewing Tommy Tai, who's the author of the Catholic Hipster Handbook. But as we said earlier in the show, we are in the process of moving. Mm-hmm. So I guess this is the time we should break it to you. We're going to be going dark next week.
Yeah.
We got to move.
Yeah.
So when we come back in a couple of weeks, though, you're going to hear his interview. So mm-hmm. ahead of that, we thought we'd ask our followers with a Z on Twitter if who is the hippest Catholic that they know?
Yeah, who's the coolest Catholic in your life? And we got some really, really good responses. So Trevor wrote in, easy, at Pontifex, Pope Francis's Twitter handle. And then Tony wrote, His Grace, Bishop Umbers, and it's not even close.
If you don't follow Bishop Umbers, it's kind of amazing because he's this bishop from Australia who is a real bishop and a real person.
Yeah.
And also like really fluent in meme culture.
Yeah, he's really like his meme game is fantastic.
It's funnier than mine.
Yeah.
100%. And some nerd named Mike said, definitely not someone who uses Z in followers. That's who. Whatever, Mike. And then Benjamin said that Gregory Hillis is a contender. Who? I agree.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Agreed.
Greg, who's a theologian and father and beer drinker
and
bourbon drinker and
contributor at America.
Yeah, contributor at America.
Okay. And by the way, you guys can follow us on Twitter and interact with us at Jesuitical Show.
Yes, we love the Twitter.
We really do.
Also, it's time to ask you guys to leave us an iTunes review.
Please.
We had a strong surge of them mm-hmm. coming, but they have slowed to a trickle.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still going to shout out the people who have left us reviews, but ahead of, we've got 2 weeks off. And so while you're checking your feed and you're sad that we're not there, remember the good times.
Yeah.
Remember the good times and then write about them.
Yeah. And then write about that because yeah. we really enjoy hearing from you guys. So leave that review and follow us and subscribe.
All right, should we do some consolations and desolations?
Yes, it's the part of the show where we tell you where we did or didn't find God this week. So what do you have, Zach?
So I have a desolation this week, and this is like a weird one to talk about, I guess, a little bit, because I almost got in a fight over the weekend.
Oh boy, what happened?
So I was at a party where there was this drunk idiot, mm-hmm. Just sort of like being creepy and aggressive and sort of was putting his hands on my girlfriend and
oh, no.
I sort of like lost it a little bit mm-hmm. and immediately escalated it to like pushing him away and like getting in his face. And then, you know, his friend comes over and says like, hey, don't touch him. And then mm-hmm. Amanda, my girlfriend, you know, played peacemaker and everyone walked away. I don't know. I think part of it was just like reading all of these Me Too stories and then mm-hmm. just like being in a situation where, you know, people are being touched and mm-hmm. they're not asking for it and they're being harassed and talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the desolating part for me was recognizing my own sinfulness, my own inadequacy, and being able to have a response that wasn't an immediate escalation to violence or protector or some other problematic role that I was trying to fulfill right there.
Mm-hmm.
And fact of the matter was that Amanda like pointed out, like we were talking about a lot, is that that's nothing new, right? And that's pretty mild compared mm-hmm. to some things that happen a lot. And mm-hmm. so that was a really desolating thing for me.
Right, right. Because it's unfortunate. You're like you said, you're hearing about this in the news and then having to see your girlfriend in that position is not at all easy.
No. And so I'm like trying to, I was really thinking about a lot for the rest of the weekend and this week about, you know, what is my role? How do I respond to situations mm-hmm. like that? How do I be supportive? How do I be a better person?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I will continue to be sitting with, I think, for a while. What do you got, Olga?
So I've got a consolation this week. I mentioned a few episodes ago that I joined this community group. And last night I went for the second time. And I've been a little... I was really excited about joining it mm-hmm. when I went to like the social that they had. And then when I went to the first one. Then I got really cynical as like, you know, the news made me cynical. And I was just like, I'm so busy at work. Like, we talk about these things all the time. I don't want to do this after hours. Like, I just want to go Netflix and chill, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But just kind of being in that space, just listening to people struggle with how they balance their Christianity with working in secular spaces. I was kind of like, wow, I'm really, really privileged to be able to work at a place where like, I literally see God in my coworkers and I see God in you guys on this podcast, you know, and the editing that I'm doing. And it was kind of consoling to see that that's like, I really see my faith every single day, you know? And then on the other hand, I also got to experience, like I was in fellowship with these people, you know? And it's very different from the fellowship. I've mentioned this before. It's very different from the fellowship I get here because they are like, these are people in their 40s and their 50s. They have kids and things. So yeah, that was a really consoling space to be in.
That's awesome. All righty, let's roll these credits. Jesuitical is brought to you by America Media and produced by Eloise Blondio. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Jesuit Formation provided by Eric Sundrup, SJ. Engineering provided by Antonio Delaware Bruce. Our logo is by Sean Tripoli. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show. And please, 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 please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and leave us a review. Shout out this week to Dama Whitney. Also, send us your questions, feedback, cocktail recipes, presents, and tell us where you found God this week at jesuitical@americamedia.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Zach Davis for America Media. See you next week.